strippers that had no formal training. These people were going to clubs, and suddenly it was like we were all stars in our little minds. And in New York, everybody already thinks they're the star. It was a perfect combination of narcissism, exhibitionism, and the internet. And Miss Shapes was right there for it.
Chris Lombardi. People wanted to see themselves or friends looking trashy or making out with somebody. Jordan Nicol. I don't know why we thought it was a good idea to take photos in the beginning. We just did. But then, after the first month or two, whoever was helping us with our website explained to us how to see the back end, where you can see how many people are looking and where they're coming from. There was a lot of people looking at our website, and they were from all over, not just New York. It was from all the United States and also in London and lots of other places. We were like, let's keep doing this. Thomas Honorato. It helped us push that party forward into the national spotlight.
Justine D. I don't think it's a bad thing, just I think it was the next step.
Thomas Honorato. My downstairs neighbor was Jessica Cohen, who was the editor of Gawker at the time, and she came up with the idea of Blue States Lose. Every single week, she would do a recap of all the photo websites. She would do her top 10 photos, and she would do a description of each photo. It was very funny and sometimes really mean, but that's what was great about it. Miss Shapes would always be half the photos. This was when Gawker was at the height of its power.
Leela's Ark. That was the best press ever, no kidding.
Jordan Nicol. You went to Miss Shapes because you wanted to get your picture taken there, and also because you never knew what band would be DJing. Sometimes it was Joe Blow from down the street. Sometimes it was Madonna. Thomas Honorato. I thought the floor was going to give way that night. Rob Sheffield. That floor, you would be like, this is seriously how we're going to fucking die. I don't care, though. It's fine.
Leela's Ark. She had to do a sound check. Our first sound check ever.
Jordan Nicol. It was just us and Madonna.
Leela's Ark. She came and did a sound check, which was all of 5 minutes, and then went downstairs and said, so where is this photo wall?
Jordan Nicol. Because she had seen our website.
Leela's Ark. And we're like, right this way, Madonna. And right away, without skipping a beat, she stood on the wall and posed.
Thomas Honorato. She played 30 minutes of her own music as a set. Of course, she can get away with that. She was with Lenny Kravitz and her nannies, which I thought was so funny. She also had a camera crew. It was like Princess Diana was coming. There was security and armed guards. She was wearing the whole disco look, a blue dress with the Harry Winston diamond eyelashes. Her arms are amazing. Her being there also represented something crucial. It reflected that the dance culture and indie rock had all fused. All those crowds that were rock people or indie people then became indie dance people. It had all fused, and we saw it, and her team saw it.
Trisha Romano. There was a sweetness to the brand of cool that the Miss Shapes were exporting. They were so pop. They were such figureheads for a relatively clean and safe version of this New York debauchery. In comparison to Darkroom, Miss Shapes was like Candyland. It was younger and lighter and freer. It's crazy. Now they DJ fashion parties all around the world and she's this big model.
Thomas Honorato. The first scene outside of New York that took Lee's face and said, "You are our generation's it girl," was the UK. And then it happened everywhere. They play like Singapore and all these markets where they DJ these huge, crazy dance parties. Jordan Nicol. The craziest thing for us is when we go anywhere, people know us. Even far-reaching places in Jakarta, Indonesia, Japan, or China, or Australia, or South America. On the street or in the airport, or if we're DJing somewhere, they come up to us. Where's a cool place to shop? What's a cool place to eat? What do you do? Where do you go? What do you like? Where do you live? What's the cool thing? People are fascinated by New York City, fascinated by your lifestyle here, or just anyone's lifestyle here.
Tricia Romano. Really, they were just little kids from New Jersey that did the thing that everybody dreams about doing, which is coming to New York and reinventing themselves. And they made it. They really made it. Lee Lazark. It's surreal.
Jordan Nicol. Because it wasn't intentional.
Lee Lazark. Nothing was intentional.
Part 4. Birth of Brooklyn. Chapter 70. Record Collection Rock. RZA. In the old days, you could walk down the street, and there would be a guy on the side of the sidewalk with 100 vinyls, and you'd buy them for $1 apiece. I was one of those kids who would buy them and take them home and find samples, find things to make music out of. I've been inspired as a DJ sampling from soul music, rock music, to the music of Leonard Cohen, to the music of Yes, you know? There was no limit. I actually sampled from a Peter Pan record, a Mickey Mouse record. We could take it in any direction as long as we were on that groove. My style of music came from having an ear. Around maybe 2004, 2005, what I noticed was there was coming up a generation of bands that were able to play to that New York experience. Before, the bands weren't able to translate hip-hop, you know what I mean? And now they can. It could be the internet, more access to music. It could have been that it takes time for something to settle in. In every generation, we absorb the music we grew up with. The children of the 70s grew up. And when we got to the 90s, you hear our music is reflecting the 70s. Even Biggie Smalls is bringing in the Diana Ross sample and the Nile Rodgers vibe. It takes that cycle. Simon Reynolds. I always used to call it record collection rock. It's an approach that really gels, that really blossomed with the internet. Pre-internet, you often found that bands had been clerks in record stores, and that they have this enormous knowledge of records and info they picked up. Or they might be fanzine writers or editors. There was a sort of nerd approach. It was quite hard-won knowledge. It involved a lot of digging, a lot of spending money, a lot of time. And then the internet just made being that kind of nerd so much easier. What was a minority personality profile became much more widespread. Todd P. TV on the radio had a foot in the previous world, but they were the first one to get big on not going after the radio crowd. They were going for a certain kind of indie crowd. But an indie crowd that wasn't the punk indie crowd. An indie crowd that found out about things through NPR. Dave Siddick. When TV on the radio started playing, when we started doing shows and everything, Tunde and I couldn't have been more shocked that anyone cared. We were more shocked than anyone. Tunde Edebimpe. My first instinct during those years, whenever I saw anyone staring at me that I didn't know, I would always think I had something on my face. Dave Siddick. My window into knowing we were doing well was my mom calling me. Weirder than me being in spin was my mom being excited. Ed Drost. One of our first support gigs was for TV on the radio, right after Yellow House came out in the fall of 2006. That was really major for us. Aaron Desner. We've always had more in common with people who don't really represent themselves as rock stars. We're more into the craft of making music. I would say the same thing about Dave Longstreth or Grizzly Bear. There's just a musical curiosity and a more varied, a more compositional thing happening. Matt Berninger. There's some early footage of us at the Mercury Lounge, and I'm hanging on the mic like I always do, smoking. And I think I even pick up a tambourine at one point. I don't fucking play the tambourine. I just didn't know what to do with my hands. We were just stiffs. We looked kind of stiff on stage. And I think we still do, compared to seeing the Strokes or Interpol. They were the greasers and we were the socks. Aaron Desner. In our little corner of Ohio, there's a self-effacing tradition in indie rock. I think of Kim and Kelly Deal, who were accidental rock stars as opposed to international leather jacket rock stars. Those were the kinds of bands we idolized. Tim Goldsworthy. With the Grizzly Bear guys, they're all really lovely, but it's not scary. It doesn't feel like they're on the outside of popular culture pushing things forward at all. It's, I like your shoes, where'd you get them? Oh, I got them off the internet. Todd P. When you really think about it, where did Dave Longstreth come from? Where did Grizzly Bear come from? From a world where musicianship was really important. Aaron Desner. Bryce and I grew up going to conservatory, and we were very technical musicians as kids. Chris Taylor. I was a jazz studies major at NYU. Then I changed majors to audio engineering. Dan also comes from a jazz background. Ed Drost. We had been booking our own tours. We basically played to 10 to 20 people a night around the country, crashing on people's floors. It wasn't until we released Yellow House in 2006 that we felt, oh, there is actually a path for us here. And it wasn't until much later, around 2008 to 2009, that we were able to quit our jobs and stuff. Aaron Desner. It was when we started to delve back into that musical background that we found our sound. Alligator is when you hear, okay, that's the National. Tim Goldsworthy. This new generation, it makes me feel sick. It should be kids who are driven to express themselves in some way, getting crap software, or picking up a guitar, or banging on things. Not kids playing fancy chords on fancy synthesizers just because they kind of sound cool. Rock and roll is about passion, and the energy of transferring what you've got and your feeling to somebody else, to a group of people. Can a technically skilled musician make great pop music? No, you can't. It gets in the way. It's just not going to happen. You've got far too much baggage. Alan Light. As the scene migrated to Brooklyn, it felt, to its credit, a little more self-sufficient, but also a little more detached. It wasn't just the millennial generation's version of boys with guitars. Matt Berninger. It was something different. The Strokes were New York. The Strokes were Manhattan. The Strokes were the Lower East Side. And you can't repeat that story. You need a new story. And the new story became Brooklyn. Ed Drost. I feel like by the time that we were releasing music, Karen O had already moved to L.A. and was dating Spike Jones or something. Chapter 71. There is a lot of confrontation, but I think it does come back to faith. David Burton. In the grand scheme of things, Yeah 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 has got down to business. The business of being a successful business, if you will. They set parameters as far as how they were going to tour, and in what fashion, and how many shows they were going to do in a row, for the sake of everyone's mental and physical well-being. Because, I mean, she put a lot on stage. Asif Ahmed. It turned when Karen moved to L.A. She moved in February 2004, and, I mean, that's no secret, that's just like, that definitely had an impact on her approach. Everyone changed.
Karen O. I was just looking for a change, you know. I just felt like if I didn't leave New York at that point, that I probably never would. I came back pretty regularly to see my family and friends, but when I moved, there were definitely large periods of time where the band didn't see each other. We kind of got on with the business of our own lives.
Asif Ahmed. I ended up moving to L.A. because I had to. Karen's parents wanted me to keep an eye on her. I kind of convinced myself it's the thing to do. Also, it was kind of put in my ear that if I didn't go out there, the band would find another manager.
April Long. At that point, it kind of seemed like they might not make another record. Karen decamped to L.A., Nick was doing his photography thing. I'd still see him around at Lit or whatever. It seemed like he was kind of holding down the New York fort. Nothing was really changing with him, but she was on this completely stratospheric trajectory. Hollywood and a completely different life. I mean, she started dating Spike Jones.
Asif Ahmed. I remember when I busted them in a car outside a venue in San Francisco. Their headlights were glaring at me when I was leaving the venue. I think I dropped my phone or something. I looked over, and they were just canoodling. I was like, "Excuse me?" The good thing about Spike was he broadened her world outside of just fucking Williamsburg. Got her out of her parents' shadow.
April Long. To go from Angus to Spike seemed kind of incredible. Striking, really. Personally, I thought it was incredibly cool. I was like, what a freaking cool couple that is. But certainly a lot of people didn't. It indicated to them that she had crossed over into something they were skeptical of. That this girl who had crawled around pouring beer all over herself was now gallivanting around with Hollywood hotshots was just kind of a little bit hard to align.
Asif Ahmed. In L.A., she was pretty healthy. She stopped drinking as much, only when her nerves got the best of her. She had a colonic girl in Santa Monica. Aruna was her name. I remember Karen and I went on the same day, and we were just sitting there laughing, and I said, "This is really... there's no boundaries now. You're seeing a speculum go in my ass."
Karen O. Nick came out and we started working on Show Your Bones. By this time, a lot of the New York scene that we came up in was already petering out, but it was terrifying because there was just no groundwork for what anyone would want to listen to in 2006. I knew I, physically and emotionally, couldn't make the same record. It's not in my nature. I have to move forward. But what I didn't know was what the fuck the next sound should be. It was already feeling like things were speeding up as far as the shelf life of bands and people's attention spans. I was already feeling the speed of that, so that was part of the enormous traumatic pain of conceiving Show Your Bones. The road hadn't been paved.
Nick Zinner. Our second record. That was torturous.
Karen O. There can be so much tension, really unhealthy tension, in the studio. I mean, you can't avoid it. It's going to be there no matter what you do. It's like trying to say, like, I just want to live life without any pain or suffering. It's just not realistic, you know? In the studio, you've got 2 days, 2 hours before you start overthinking it.
Nick Zinner. It's torturous. It's really, really hard. I'm sure a million artists have phrased it a lot better than me. But it's looking for this minutia that is not actively there. You're throwing everything against the wall to see what sticks. Brian Chase. We're trying out a lot of ideas, and they came in really, really rough shape. I'd say over 90% of the ideas that we put on there don't get used. The final songs end up being a kind of distilled essence. And in that process of refinement comes a lot of saying no. Nick Zinner. That was another time Siddick picked me up and moved me, or like, shifted my world. We were doing our second record, and I was on my 5th nervous breakdown. It was the worst, darkest time imaginable, and I was freaking out, having intense panic attacks. He wasn't even producing that record. He was in the studio next door. This was at Headgear Studios in Williamsburg. Stay Gold was the studio Siddick opened in the same building, so he was just next door. I was totally losing it, and he picked me up and brought me back into the world. And he was like, fucking play the guitar. He listed off 1,000 reasons why it wasn't so bad, and he totally saved my life. Dave Siddick. I physically picked Nick up and threw him into the recording booth and held the door shut. I said, "You're not coming out of that fucking room until you finish this fucking guitar part. And I want my studio back, so fucking do it now." He was really mad. And he played so fast and so loud that it wound up being like the best thing ever. Asif Ahmed. There were creative differences on how to get the next record off the ground, following her move and the Spike thing. All of a sudden, Spike's little brother, Squeak E. Clean, became producer extraordinaire. When I had Flood lined up, and I had Steve Lillywhite, I had Steven Street, Steve Albini, people that would make better sense sonically. In the end, I will say the album sounds great. It was his first big record, and he did it. And I don't think Karen had ever written and recorded at the same time. so God bless her for taking that on. But it took a toll on the band. Nick Zinner. Why was it so bad? I don't know. Karen and I hated each other. We didn't trust each other. Asif Ahmed. Karen is very hard to fight with because she can turn a room cold. When she's happy, everyone around her is happy. When she's upset, everyone around her is upset. That's her star power. But that's also a tantrum, and I resented her for that quite a bit. Nick Zinner. Karen and I were like two thunderclouds rubbing up against each other. Asif Ahmed. Those two were like brother and sister, very Wednesday and Pugsley. Brian Chase. There are great moments, too. There's fun mixed in there. Hearing songs come to life is an amazing moment. Nick Zinner. I don't know if fun is the right word, but it can be totally enjoyable. It's more just like things work or they don't work, and you can't really figure out the reasons why. I think what it comes down to is it's healthy to have a little bit of friction. It's probably essential to have a little bit, but you just learn ways to have it not be a lot. There's no reason why it has to be a miserable experience. Brian Chase. There is a lot of confrontation, but I think it does come back to faith. Nick Zinner. You know, I actually love that record now.
April Long. Show Your Bones didn't have the propulsive, slinky moxie of Fever to Tell, but it did have a tunefulness and a sort of intimacy that most critics responded positively to. The album was nominated for a Grammy and debuted in the top 20. It felt like they had really made it into the big time, but also like they had lost a little something getting there. There was a lot of restraint on that record, and restraint was definitely not something you'd ever associate with Yeah Yeah Yeahs. You could tell that the dynamic of the band had changed.
Asif Ahmed. There was a term that Karen used on the second record, Gwennomics, because she didn't want to be marketed as a pop star, as the label also handled Gwen Stefani and No Doubt. It was hard to not notice how Gwen's solo career took off the same year Fever to Tell started getting more attention, that it was a bit much for Karen at the time, being 25, and new to another level of label attention and marketing. I remember hearing Gwen was a little weird about Karen, because she was the new girl on Interscope and Gwen was the queen bee. Then Jimmy focused all of his attention on Karen, because she reminded him so much of Patti Smith, Chrissy Hynde, Debbie Harry, and Susie Sue, all these girls rolled up in one. She was an amalgam of all that, whether or not she'd admit to it. But she didn't want to be marketed that way.
Karen O. I always felt like because I was a woman, I just had a completely different perspective. I felt like my brain literally worked differently than everyone around me, which was all men. And so, therefore, I was not beholden to the rules of the game, which is a big thing in the rock world. It's very dutiful. There's a legacy that is laid out. There's a canon of rock, and a lot of men worship that and kneel at the altar of that. I didn't have to play by those rules. I mean, I felt super, super isolated and super lonely because I could never really fully relate to my male bandmates and peers. I could relate to them only to a certain degree, and they're the bomb. They're so progressive, wise, intuitive, really wonderful fucking rocking human beings. But they're dudes, you know? In the end, they're not fellow ladies. And that was like, I mean, it's hard to know how much that's impacted my career and my drive as an artist, but probably a fucking huge amount.
Asif Ahmed. They were also very threatened that I had other clients. I look back and I'm like, stupid, 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 because they're not even that big. Who was bigger than Yeah Yeah Yeahs then? Everybody! Like the Killers. I'll never forget this. I booked the goddamn Killers as their opening act for their tour on the West Coast. The Killers' first big tour. And then I couldn't even meet with them. Yeah Yeah Yeahs would never let me go and work with other, bigger bands. Another one was the Distillers. Brody wanted me to be manager, and then that mysteriously vanished.
Karen O. We were competitive. Everyone was. Allison Mossart. This is a competitive sport. We all want to outplay each other. Think of the nature of all these bands. We were all dark, secretive fuckers doing arty stuff. It is competitive, and brilliantly so. That's how it should be.
Asif Ahmed. You start resenting them for not doing the business aspect they're supposed to. They'll agree to do a tour, and then they'll cancel it. We don't like this label. Why did you sign us to this label? And during that second record cycle, they had a different set of friends coming in to oversee things, whispering into everyone's ear. I couldn't win. After a certain point, I just gave up. My feeling was, I'm not gonna win if the motherfucking girl who designed your handbags is telling you, well, a friend of mine does this. I just thought, well, you know what? Go have your motherfucking dumb bitch friend who sells t-shirts manage your fucking band. I stopped caring about making them happy.
Karen O. Asif just enjoys being adversarial with the label so much, which we loved for so long. In the beginning, it just totally worked in our favor. He totally got off on saying the wrong thing, humiliating those two powerful rich men, and they loved the shit out of him. They loved being abused by him, and he loved to abuse them. He had that sociopathic streak, which we also loved because it was what we felt like we needed at the time. But eventually it became, okay, this is a problem.
Asif Ahmed. Right after that, I started working with Courtney Love. I saw Karen, Nick, and Brian as training for Courtney. Courtney emailed Karen about me. She wanted to know what Karen was like. And Karen emailed saying, I can't believe you're doing this. I think the band got a little pissed. That whole second record was just a real line in the sand. It was brutal. We went from being super close, then super dysfunctional, to no one talking at all.
Christian Joy. I think the interesting thing about Yeah Yeah Yeahs is that they do evolve. They could have stayed with her trying to still be a 20-year-old maniac, but that would lose its appeal. It's nice that she still seemed able to embrace the performance and have these moments. She slowed down, but she's still just incredible to watch. Every single time, it's so captivating, and it doesn't matter if she's a wild maniac or doing her slowed-down thing. She's extremely captivating. Karen O. For some people, there's no boundary between life and art, you know? I think there's totally a boundary for me. That's why it could seem like as neat as flipping a switch.
Asif Ahmed. Karen always said this one thing. I want to be successful, but I don't want to be famous. She was like, I want to be able to walk down the street and not have my life ruined. And I have to tell her, she's accomplished that. Harmar Superstar. I think she liked to stir trouble and be more of a weird downtown art girl before she had attention. And then when she got the attention, she said, no, I don't want the attention. Jaleel Bundan. I watched her become a superstar, a personality, which I could not fucking handle, man. If you don't know Karen, you don't know that she is a fucking real person. She's not the kind of person that loves being like, I'm the most powerful person in the room. That's not her vibe at all. But when she gets on stage, she is that to so many people. She's iconic, which is weird to say, but she is. I just saw how difficult it is to maintain your humanity in that, and watching her do it, I'm really grateful. Chapter 72. The creative process, while it can definitely reward the ego, it can fucking bruise it, too. Daniel Kessler. Once it's on, it's on.
Jenny Penny. After the Antics tour, which went on forever, Carlos finally came back and said, so what do we do now?
Daniel Kessler. You're coming and going, going and coming. Anyone who's gone on vacation for a couple of weeks understands that a little bit, but it's non-stop. You feel like, I don't even have time to clean my clothes. Paul Banks. In general, it's just a hard thing to do, to keep liking each other, Even really veteran bands, you realize the dynamics are all fucked up in between members. It's inevitable. Psychologically, it's just bedlam. Daniel Kessler. You've got to look for the fun. Everybody has different ways for making tour life work for them. Part of mine is always to use your inner GPS to remember those cool places in different cities. I love this cafe. I want to go back there. They had the best breakfast. That breakfast place stays open until 2. Yes, I win. It's like a bit of a victory. Paul Banks. My entire philosophy has been that wisdom, self-awareness, and all thought should be fluid. When I was in college, I loved this notion. It's from Thoreau, that your past self is this cadaver that you carry around with you. And there's this sense that you need to stay true to who you were, not veer from your path in a way that will alienate your peers from you. According to Thoreau, we needed to let all that go. He said that at any given moment, we should be open to contradiction or self-contradiction or changing of paths. I've believed in that. So I didn't buy into fixed modes of working, fixed notions of what a band should do or a song should do. But then you work with people that do have that, I want to communicate this, and I want it to be like this way of being. There's a tension there. Sam Fogarino. We went back to the UK a number of times during that period, but I wasn't going and hanging out with Paul and Carlos, going to these house parties where they would run into so-and-so from the Libertines or whatever. I was chasing my own kind of fun, which was just breaking off and hanging out with different people. If there was going to be a bag of drugs done, it would be at somebody's swanky apartment or a swank hotel room in L.A. or New York or Chicago or wherever we were. Their partying was just annoying, you know? Harmar Superstar. I love just getting coked up with Paul and having him talk about how buttery Julian's voice is. It's like butter, dude. I don't understand. Paul Banks. I would get in deep conversations with people, and I would feel like, it's not just I'm watching you be fucked up. It's like I'm interacting with you, and we're talking about shit that we wouldn't be talking about if we weren't here at 5 in the morning high on coke.
Sarah Lewitton. Sam never really hung out.
Sam Fogarino. I really didn't care, but it also didn't get in my way. I was too busy meeting Michael Stipe and Mario Batali and Bob Mould and all these other people. I felt, these are the real fruits of labor here. I'm going to get shit-faced drinking a bunch of wine with Mario Batali. It's going to be so much more fun than doing rails of coke with some sluts at the dark room. Paul Banks. I liked the raunchy, uninhibited quality of being out really late with people. But I'm prone to wanton self-abuse. It's sort of like going down a road and having to realize, okay, I've seen what's on this road, and I'd be repeating myself. The core you is there, the adventurer, so to speak. It's just that you have to move on and do other things. Sam Fogarino. Yes, I was worried. By the Antics era, hence the name of the record, it was like, these guys are not just cokeheads. They're waking up with beers in their hands. They're full-on alcoholics. It's just not fun to be around. I did my share of junk, but I was like, time and place. It's not at 12 noon. I really didn't like it. Paul Banks. Eventually became about survival. I was burning the candle. I mean, the candle was just going to go out. My personality and my work were suffering. My ability to do work. My life had become just the partying. Sam Fogarino. By then, you know, I didn't say anything because they would be fighting words. You couldn't tell those guys anything. They were just so in over their heads with this newfound lifestyle that nobody was going to penetrate any sense into them. Paul Banks. Even when I was a real partier, I always had a voice of my own that said, I'm on safari right now. I was making mental notes. I wanted to know how raunchy shit got. I wanted to feel it. I'm a pretty sleazy person. I liked it. I wanted to be there. But there were also other things that I wanted to do and to accomplish. It's still very exotic and awesome. I still would love to go back and be a fuck-up for a couple years. but then I'd be repeating myself. Part of the reason why I wound up getting sober was an experience I had when I was really fucked up and I ran into Jaleel Bunton, the drummer for TV on the Radio. I've known him since forever, from when I went to Max Fish all the time. Also, Jaleel worked at Oren's Coffee across from NYU. I dated one of his co-workers, actually. Kareem Bunton. Paul's still mad at Jaleel because Paul was in love with some girl. Paul said, "I told your brother that I was in love with this girl and he stole her." I said, like, "You never tell him that, dude. She wasn't hot until you said something." Jaleel Bunton. She didn't actually become my girl, but don't tell Paul that. Stuart Lupton actually stole the girl from me that Paul thinks I stole from him. So there you go. Stuart won that battle. Paul Banks. I remember running into Jaleel one night when I was really fucked up, and I could see in his face what he was thinking. "Dude, you're fucking slipping, man." He didn't say anything, but it made me feel embarrassed for myself. It was just the look I saw in his eyes. I was never a Jekyll and Hyde drunk or anything. I never blacked out. I never did anything too crazy. But I could just see it register in his face that I was not looking good, that he wasn't really that excited to be standing in front of me in that moment. And it made me feel really, really bad. The look he gave me made me wince deep down inside. Jaleel Bunton. I do remember seeing him and having the thought, "You're better than this." Sam Fogarino. All the touring ended around October 2005. We got a rehearsal space in Midtown Manhattan. I remember I broke in there with a friend to write some of my own music. It was my first foray working on music outside of Interpol. I was just kind of waiting for the band to get back to it. Our contract was fulfilled with Matador. There were major labels knocking at the door, lots of monies being talked about. And we kind of entered that phase where we were very cocky and felt we were invincible. And the writing sessions that took place were awful. Nobody liked each other. Paul Banks. The band was just... yeah, we weren't getting along at all. Sam Fogarino. Everybody felt personally responsible for everything good about the band and everything good that had happened. And everybody felt insecure that the next person didn't like them anymore. So there was this big narcissistic, egotistical, emotional conflict in the room. Paul Banks. Carlos and I were just constant loggerheads. We had a horrible relationship at that point. And Sam was in a very dark place, unbeknownst even to me, because he was kind of just dealing with his shit quietly. Sam Fogarino. I started taking liquid Vicodin out of a dropper because I couldn't stand to be around everybody. It got so argumentative. Everything was a debate. If anybody tried to pitch an idea that Daniel wasn't involved with, he would retract. He would be in the room, but then he was no longer present. Carlos and Paul were... I think their egos didn't care. I just wasn't going to push buttons. And I wasn't happy, though, so I made myself happy. And at the same time, we're discussing Paul's situation, which was so over the top that he was about to go to rehab. And on the day that our mini-intervention took place, I was high as a kite. Paul Banks. Every artist that has longevity is constantly self-adjusting between having confidence, but not too much confidence, having ambition, but not too much ambition. I err more on the side of humility, because I'm depressive. A key ingredient that I've noticed to people that are really successful is they don't experience self-doubt in the ways that depressive people do. Sam Fogarino. The creative process, while it can definitely reward the ego, it can fucking bruise it too. Paul Banks. The first time I saw Jay-Z in an interview, what dawned on me was whatever Michael Jordan has in his legs, that guy has in his brain chemistry. That dude's brain chemistry is so fucking right. Do you know what I mean? Not only is he very gifted and talented, many people are, but his brain chemistry is the serenest thing. He's just like so charismatic, calm, and cool. And I was just like, oh, I see. That's part of the package of gifts that he received. I wasn't coddled enough by life for that sense of everything I do is good. I more have a feeling that everything I do is not very good, as opposed to everything I do is amazing and people just don't get it. I feel like there are no real answers. It's just this fluid balance between narcissism and humility. Matt Berninger. You need a certain amount of posturing to even have the guts to stand on stage and sing. It's humiliating. You have to turn yourself into a little bit of a caricature just to not hate yourself. It's so silly. The gall of thinking you can be a cool rock star. To be one, you have to be a delusional douchebag a little bit, right? But then, if you pull that off and deliver on inventive music and good lyrics and passionate performance, that's everything. Sam Fogarino. Both Paul and Carlos went clean, and Carlos had no qualms in talking about everything he did not like anymore. It was kind of sad. I mean, I was happy that he wasn't doing copious amounts of cocaine anymore, but that guy that was fun to be around was gone. He's gone and he's miserable, and he doesn't want to pick up the bass anymore. I don't know how, but we made it into the studio. Paul Banks. What Our Love to Admire taught me was everything not to do in a creative process. I worked myself way too hard and tried way too hard. I got nodes on my vocal cords. I was sitting under a desk rocking one night in the studio. Just really wrong, 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 overthinking everything. Sam Fogarino. Mentally, I was quitting the band every week. Paul Banks. I should have gone to more movies, and then walked back to the studio and seen what happened. At that point, I still had this notion that I could make a great song out of anything. Then I realized, no, I can't. Sam Fogarino. I really don't know how the record got written. It was heavy. It was the band kind of coming apart at the seams. And that's what you hear on that record. Daniel Kessler. Right before making it, we kind of knew that it probably wasn't going to come out on Matador. Chapter 73. Selling out is so passé. Paul Banks. People made more attention of the switch to Capitol than we anticipated. I just assumed it would no longer be a point of discussion once you heard we hadn't made a sellout record. It was like, if the quality control is still contained within the band, what is there to lose? Also, by that point, we were the only band left on an indie. All these super hip indie bands were on majors. Alan Light. When you're talking about those bands earlier in the century, they were still dependent on a label, a studio. They needed access to somewhere to record and needed someone to distribute. 5 years later, technologically, you don't need those things. You can record at home on a laptop. You can distribute. You just need somebody to notice. That's the only challenge that's left. Labels become either peripheral or an excuse to take an advance, but that's about it. Rostam Batmanglij. In college, I had a friend who was obsessed with getting signed to a major label. I was fascinated by the idea of it. I just found it interesting. On an anthropological level, the idea of these games built around these major dying corporations.
Kim Gordon. There was definitely a change. It's definitely different than when we started.
James Barber. Why is it bad to sell out? Isn't that supposed to be a self-evident thing? Moby. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, and I watched this with some friends of mine, they could make idiosyncratic music and do nothing, or compromise and sell 5 million records. So there was a lot of pressure put on people to compromise. And the carrot that they dangled in front of these bands was, if you compromise and you make a record that sells like Hoobastank or Bush, you will suddenly be playing Madison Square Garden and have a humidor in the back of your Rolls Royce. Juan McLean. There were bands that were on independent labels, and the major labels would sign them and subsequently clean up their sound and make it more palatable for a larger audience. These bands that had big underground followings would lose their entire fan base in exchange for a much bigger mainstream fan base. And in the process, they had to make their recording sound a lot different. They had to be able to be played on mainstream radio. Moby. Of course, that became very distasteful, and so a lot of indie, not just music, but art, movies, and everything, started moving away from that path. Juan McClain. In the 90s, just by being immersed in this underground music scene, you socially had taken a stance and were a member of a group. It was a group that generally had a set of ideas and behaviors and ways of doing things that were pretty universal from place to place. Even by the clothes that you wore back then, you really stuck out as being different. There was a sort of rallying cry of, oh, we're not normal people. It was all in the way you dressed and the music that you listened to. Carl Swanson. The concepts of the mainstream and the non-mainstream, and all of that coming up through punk and in the post-punk era in the 80s, was in opposition to the mainstream rock era, which itself was just like a luxury sedan and cocaine version of hippie thing, which itself was another reaction to something else. It's all just about being in opposition to, the antithesis to, the thing going on at the time. Jonathan Galkin. Back then, there was always that shop in every town, the one place that sells Doc Martens, and that would be the place. They'd have a shoe place upstairs, and downstairs was all vinyl. Because you used to be able to go to, like, the goth Army-Navy record store place. That New Order poster on the wall in the DFA office? That's from one of those places. I had it on my bedroom wall in junior high school. Juan McClain. I've been in my share of fights over the years, and many of them were started by something as trivial as wearing Chuck Taylors in the 80s, which seems insane now. It seems inconceivable. But riding on the subway in Boston, wearing Chuck Taylors and having a funny haircut made me the target of just about any other kid my age. And that was part of the appeal. We were people who looked around at the mainstream and were like, I don't want to be a part of this.
Kim Gordon. There was the whole put-it-out-yourself thing, the indie labels thing. But it was also about, why are you doing it? Why are you making music? Are you doing it because you want to have a hit record and be famous and rich? Or are you doing it because you really want to play music and you don't care if you actually end up having some day job? Being in an indie rock band was like being a blues musician or a jazz musician. All the noise musicians, or like most musicians, you're just eking out a living so you could play.
James Barber. You're always going to get me back to the class thing. One thing that happened in the 80s is a generation of kids who went to college started playing music for a living, and Sonic Youth are the first of that. All of a sudden, there are kids who went to Brown, who went to Harvard, who went to Michigan, who went to Berkeley, who are forming these underground bands. And they come from a background that's way different than the working-class kids who had historically been the rock musicians, or the jazz musicians, or the R&B musicians. So in a way, the rise of dealing with the man is bad is connected with the entry of people who can afford to have those attitudes. Look at it this way. Historically, musicians are people who are, if I can make this work, I don't have to go work at the tuna canning plant or pump gas at the gas station. But all of a sudden it became, if I can make this band work, I don't have to go to law school. Chris Lombardi. There were rock stars, there were famous people, and then there were the New York rock stars, the indie rock stars. James Barber. It's like, we don't want that many people to hear our music, because the people that we don't want to hear our music don't deserve to hear it. Carl Swanson. The idea of selling out came from a time of plenty. It's a luxury idea, the idea that you're avoiding your otherwise boring, prosperous fate. That idea of worrying about your credibility is a luxury notion. Juan McClain. That sense of community is something I tried to hold on to with DFA, which is less a record label and more a group of friends doing the same thing. It's kind of like a tightly knit social group. Carl Swanson. My boyfriend is from Detroit, grew up in the projects, and selling out is not something he worries about. James Barber. I actually think that though there was a very vocal, articulate group of people who have claimed these politics, the overwhelming majority of people who were in bands would have jumped at the opportunity to sell out if they could get a look at it. The sort of poison underneath this whole, like, it's not cool to want to be successful goes back to art school people, right? If you're an opera singer or a painter or whatever, there's got to be a sense that you don't give a fuck about what people think about you, 'cause you're a fine artist. And it's built into the notion of being a fine artist in the second half of the 20th century. You are performing for art's sake, because there's no possibility of becoming Elvis Presley. So when people from that culture, from that educated culture, from Kim Gordon's background start wandering into rock, they bring this, oh man, I like the Fugues and the Velvet Underground, and people who were real artists, who didn't go on the Ed Sullivan Show. Someone like Iggy became a pole star for people who saw the world that way. But would Iggy have been happy to dance around for Ed Sullivan? Fuck yeah. He just didn't get the opportunity. Would the MC5 have been happy to be on the episode of the Brady Bunch? Yes! Chris Lombardi. Then Sonic Youth signed with a major label. James Barber. That was a huge moment. Geffen didn't have its 90s reputation yet. Sonic Youth kind of made that reputation happen. Geffen was Whitesnake in Guns N' Roses. It's almost like signing to Geffen was a piece of performance art, it was so ridiculous. So Sonic Youth did not fit the model of aspiring rock radio corporate rock at all. And they sort of changed the notion of what corporate rock could be. Chris Lombardi. It was Nirvana that opened it all up. They were the ones. James Barber. Nirvana said they signed to Geffen because Sonic Youth made it okay. And at least inside the company, Kim Gordon got the credit for hipping the label to Nirvana in the first place. And at some point, Sonic Youth renegotiated their recording contract, and they got rewarded for Nirvana. They got a ridiculous amount. I don't know the numbers exactly, because there was a nice lid on it. But Sonic Youth's contribution to bringing Nirvana to Geffen was recognized by the company, and they were rewarded for it. Chris Lombardi. When Nirvana came on board, the thing that was our thing was becoming everybody else's. Dave Gottlieb. They opened it up just enough so that these other bands could break through. James Barber. There was this moment from, say, spring of 92 through 97, when labels all recognized that they didn't see Nirvana coming. And so the senior people at major labels said, we don't know anything. We'll try everything. Chris Lombardi. It was this crazy circus where there was so much money being thrown around at bands. And there were copycat bands like Stone Temple Pilots who came along and sold millions of records because they were the poor man's Nirvana. James Barber. There aren't any more Nirvanas. But at the time, people didn't understand, at least people in the business didn't understand, why they had been so successful. So King Missile got signed to Atlantic Records. Guided by Voices had a major label deal. People who couldn't write songs that lasted more than 90 seconds. Then the giant consolidation happens in 98, 99, when all the labels that were out there signing everything in the world got merged. We went from 5 to 3 pretty quickly, didn't we? And then there were hundreds of records that never got released. Bands got dropped. You could write a book about the bands who got signed to labels and never had an album come out in 97, 98, 99, 2000. That's a whole story. So what's really interesting is this moment that we're talking about, for the bands we're talking about. The evil warnings of getting swallowed by the system had actually really just happened to a bunch of artists. They had reason to be worried. Juan McClain. By the time DFA formed in the late 90s, we're talking about a time when indie rock in general, which was what it was all starting to be called, had gone in a direction that I really hated. All the important bands that I had been really excited about and got me into making that music had gone away. Or signed to major labels or something. Swans, butthole surfers, Jesus lizard, even Sonic Youth. In the beginning, I was a huge fan of them, and they ended up signing to a major label. They just became very uninteresting to me. Indie rock became a sound, and that sound was guys wearing sweaters strumming guitars. Harmar Superstar. The DIY thing is supposed to be about inclusivity, but it can sometimes just be super exclusive. Connor Oberst. We were brought up on that hyper-indie militant myth. Our heroes were Fugazi and Discord and Merge and Matador. We had the archetypal record store with the really snooty guy. And looking back, you can see what a joke it was, and how limited in scope his vision of the world was. He was a great guy, and he changed my life so much. But he didn't have any idea about the music industry, and his visions were uninformed. The more I learned, the more I realized it isn't about indie versus major. It's about getting a lawyer to look at your contract. Carl Swanson. What was becoming the dominant force in pop culture, as it is now with Jay-Z and stuff, was a celebration of success, a celebration of making it. Harmar Superstar. We were coming out of that era where everything was precious and everybody was fucking concerned about the sellout conversation. I was like, dudes. I was a big advocate for selling out as much as possible. James Murphy. I came to this conclusion that Bjork is consistently more ambitious than most indie bands that are supposed to be the underground. So what's the point of the indie bands if there's just another little set of little rules? How is that more freedom? Harmar Superstar. I'm kind of anti-punk, because I grew up living by Ian MacKaye's morals, and they're cool. It's cool that he got away with it, but literally, he's one of 10 dudes that can go on tour and play $5 shows and still survive. The rest of us are just dragging our faces through dirt and sleeping in vans and eating dry cornflakes. You think, it would be cool to get paid for this at some point. It's more punk, I think, saying, I want to get paid for all this work I'm doing. Or would you rather someone work at a video store and not make that album that you're about to freak out about for 2 years? Chris Lombardi. We finally grew up and realized that the bands have to want to be successful. There does have to be an element of ambition. James Murphy. The Stooges wanted to take over. Suicide wanted to be big. Some bands say, I don't care if people listen. And I was like, well, what's the fucking point of that? To me, it's all about communication. I wanted it to be personal, but we were really ambitious. I was just getting out of my indie rut. Carl Swanson. The idea of reluctance toward mainstream success, that entire concept was destroyed by changes in technology. Mark Spitz. Any differentiation between indie and major labels became moot because of global digitization. It erased any distinction between those terms, both in a literal way, as in indie labels were no longer any different, practically, from major labels, and also on an ideological level, as in indie culture was no longer uniformly cool, and mainstream culture uniformly square. The whole indie versus mainstream thing became quaint. The labels were eventually indistinguishable from one another. The only difference between a Merge and an Interscope was that an Interscope publicist would buy you sushi instead of beer. James Barber. And you know what? The line between indie and major was never as black and white as you'd like. Mark Spitz. The people Kurt Cobain feared wore suits and ties and pantsuits from Barney's or Fred Siegel. It was the slickness that I guess stayed with the majors and the lack of slickness that stayed with the indies. But if you have a platinum card and you're wearing an old Slint t-shirt and Dickies, it's almost more honest to wear a suit. Moby. When people weren't buying records, there was no way to sell out even if you wanted to. Harmar Superstar. I used to stay with the Shins at their house when they all still lived in Albuquerque. They were recording their first album in the basement. I said, you guys should maybe take this to a real studio. Then they released it and did pretty well. When they did that McDonald's commercial, everyone was pissed at them. My response was, dudes, they got $10,000. That pays their rent for like a year. And now they can continue being musicians like you want them to be. What's the problem? McDonald's owes me $10,000? I would take it if they offered it.